I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. The last tragic note of our Civil War rang out 150 years ago this week in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. The end of the war that saved the Union marks also the start of many other things. It might well have been called the Second American Republic, with the ban on slavery in a reshaped constitution. Also the gift of birthright citizenship and the extension of equal protection of the law and voting rights to the former slaves. It was the seed time of industrial expansion, of the Gilded Age of inequality, and the fair share progressive movement all at once. We linger this hour on a side pocket of the American story, popularly neglected, mostly unknown. 13 years of Reconstruction, as it was called, to bind up the wounds of a vicious war, to enact Lincoln's new birth of freedom. It was a brave shot that missed the main target by a mile and was abandoned. Reconstruction today is a case study in the use and abuse of history. It is still a mine of American visions, both noble and nasty, that bear uncannily on our condition and our differences today about who we are, who's in, who's out of the game of self-rule in a federal union. Eric Foner is our teacher this hour from Columbia University in New York, with Heather Cox Richardson of Boston College in our studio. Eric Foner, you're prolific, maybe preeminent in 19th century America, again this spring with Gateway to Freedom, your study of the Underground Railroad. On Reconstruction, as a teacher of teachers, you would seem to have turned a whole field around. To bait the hook, here is the drama of 1865, reassembled as broadcast news by clever producers of CBS's You Are There back in the 1940s. These are flashpoints of the congressional fight over Reconstruction, fired by Republicans of the North known as radicals for wanting to impose a harsh peace on the South.
As to the southern states, I recognize no such thing as a southern state.
I resent that, sir.
The territories to the south forfeited their right to statehood when they voted themselves out of the Union.
But, Mr. Stevens, according to the late President Lincoln, the war was fought to prevent the southern states from leaving the Union.
The late President Lincoln, to the contrary, the war was not fought to keep the Union. It was fought to rid this nation of a southern aristocracy that fed and bloated itself on the vile institution of human slavery.
But slavery has been abolished, Congressman Stevens, and the southern states are asking to be brought back into the Union.
They can be brought back, and in time they will, but only when they come back as prodigals, aware of the enormity of their crimes, only after they have earned the price of admission.
What is that price of admission, Congressman?
Complete equality for the Negro, including the right to vote.
Eric Foner, this story was made for mythology, for radio drama, maybe. From you, would love to get it straight. How did it happen, Reconstruction, and the failure of it?
Well, first of all, it sort of brings me, it's kind of nostalgic to hear that You Are There episode. I used to watch that on TV, and I learned a lot of history from it, although the history that we just heard was a little bit melodramatic and not really accurate from a modern point of view, although Thaddeus Stevens was certainly a... Very strong advocate of racial equality, of the right to vote for blacks. He even wanted to distribute the land of the former planters to the former slaves in 40 acres of land and a mule for each, which would have given them a kind of economic foundation for the political freedom they had gained after the end of the Civil War.
Sure. But they had all the cards, and they had won the war. How did they blow the finale?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, first of all, people like Stevens did not control Congress at all. It was much more moderate Republicans, but even they came to very quickly feel that the former slaves needed federal protection, needed equal right before the law, and eventually they moved to black suffrage, black male suffrage, as the only way to keep the former rebels from taking power in the South and trying to guarantee the basic rights of the former slaves. You know, I think we have to say that Reconstruction was a remarkable moment in American history. The, as you mentioned before, the passage of national civil rights laws for the first time, the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution. The 14th Amendment could not be ratified today if it were put up before Congress in three-quarters or two-thirds of the states.
Hold on, you got to check you on that one. Can that be, 14th Amendment, equal protection of the
Could not
law.
Be ratified today. Absolutely not. Without all sorts of caveats. First of all, the 14th Amendment establishes birthright citizenship. Anybody born in this country is a citizen. There's a lot of people today who resent that because they don't think the children of immigrants, undocumented immigrants, should be citizens of the United States. But they are. This was a statement about that you didn't have to be of a certain race, of a certain religion, of a certain ethnic background. Even, you know, it didn't matter who your parents were to be a citizen of the United States and then to enjoy equality before the law. No, forget that. The Congress today would never pass a measure like that.
I wonder. I got to just make a reservation.
Don't wonder. Just look at who's in Congress, and you don't have to wonder very much.
It's certainly a point of resonance between issues then and issues now, but keep going.
Yeah, well, citizenship, equality, voting rights, those are issues in our newspapers today. They're not just in the 150 years ago in Reconstruction. But
Absolutely.
Anyway, because of the – what happened was that after Lincoln's assassination, as you know, his vice president, Andrew Johnson, became president, and he has a strong claim to being the worst president in American history. There is a lot of competition for that title, but Johnson, I think, has the inside track. And he basically set up new governments in the South, completely controlled by whites, with blacks having no rights whatsoever. And they passed all these laws, the so-called black codes, to try to force the former slaves back to work as, servile laborers on the plantations. And this alarmed many in the North. It seemed like the old rebellion was coming back into power, that slavery was being restored in, not in name, but in fact. And it led Congress into this giant fight with Andrew Johnson, which eventually they passed over his vetoes, the first civil rights legislation in American history, the 14th Amendment, which he opposed, and eventually African-American suffrage in the South, and eventually the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, and almost, not quite, removing him from office. But that set in motion what we call radical Reconstruction, which led to the establishment of new governments in the South based on, for the first time in American history, a kind of interracial democracy with African-Americans voting alongside of whites and holding office. And that was a remarkable experiment, but it, as you suggested, it did not succeed. It was faced with violence, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, groups like that, what you might call homegrown American terrorism.
Absolutely.
And eventually the North lost its commitment. Northern Republicans lost their desire to protect the rights of blacks in the South, and Northern intervention became less and less. And eventually these governments were overthrown in the South and replaced by, you know, white supremacist governments who then over the next generation, not immediately, but by the turn of the century, you know, put into place the system we call Jim Crow, which was a kind of comprehensive system of inequality based on, taking the right to vote away from black men and economic inequality and racial segregation and many other things. So, you know, I'm giving you a nutshell of a very complex history, but that's basically what happened.
I want to ask, what was the North's piece in it, both you say losing interest or losing nerve, but also economic interest?
I think, first of all, in 1873, the country falls into a serious economic depression, and that kind of shifts public attention away from issues in the South to, you know, labor-capital relations in the North, unemployment, economic problems, etc. The Northern industry, Northern bankers, railroad men, yeah, of course, they wanted to invest in the South, but actually they didn't want to invest in the South until government was stable and predictable there, and they weren't that interested in black rights either. And so, in fact, most Northern investment comes after the end of Reconstruction. They're much more happy to deal with well-to-do white Southerners who are kind of more like them than governments controlled by poor former slaves and that sort of thing.
I have this almost idiotic impulse in things like this to look for the three main points around the question of how the purpose of the war was lost. In this case, three things come to mind, a lot of it from reading you, which is which are the loss of Lincoln, the political imagination and the stature, but also, and speak of these particularly, money power, sheer money power, and the value of the investment in basically stolen labor, and third, terrorism. This is a kind of birth of terrorism, and it won. That's the shocking thing.
Well, yeah, all those things are quite right. I mean, Lincoln did not, one of the myths, many myths of Reconstruction is that Lincoln had a kind of clear plan. He didn't. Lincoln's qualities of greatness was his willingness to grow, to change his mind, to confront situations and rethink his assumptions. Not all politicians have that, let's just put it that way. So when Lincoln died, he had moved very far from earlier views of Reconstruction. In his last speech, just a few days before he died, he talked about giving the right to vote to some African Americans in the South. He said, you know, what he called the very intelligent, that was these free black people. He was particularly talking about New Orleans, Louisiana, and also the soldiers. 200,000 black men had fought in the Union Army and Navy, and he thought they had, you know, earned the right to equal citizenship. That was not universal suffrage, but it certainly was way ahead of the curve as far as most Northerners were concerned in 1865. Nobody knows what would have happened if Lincoln had not died, but we can certainly say he would not have gotten himself into the fix that Andrew Johnson did, totally alienated from Congress, totally alienated from Northern public opinion, almost impeached. It's inconceivable that Lincoln, who was such a savvy politician and so plugged into the Republican Party, would have gotten himself impeached and almost removed from office. The problem of Reconstruction was a tremendous problem, and what Lincoln would have done to confront, let us say, terrorism in the South, nobody has any idea.
We're going to come back to Lincoln, but I also want to come back to the sunken investment in that system and the sheer money value of it and how that money became power. But I also want to consider the fact of, not only the fact of terrorism, 4,000 lynchings over the period, but the reasons that they went unpunished, Franklin Roosevelt, nobody until wanted to touch an anti-lynching law. And I think there's still a great deal of explaining to do around that. A lot of explaining to do about everything. With Eric Foner of Columbia University and Heather Cox Richardson of Boston College in our studio, we're talking about Reconstruction, which began before the end of the war and was abandoned in the late 1870s. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, relearning our history in Reconstruction, working out the aftermath of slavery and the unimaginably destructive war that ended it. Abraham Lincoln, before he was killed, called it the greatest question ever presented to practical statesmanship. But what, in fact, had he intended in the work of Reconstruction that actually began 2 years before the war was over? Here is the Spielberg Hollywood version from the movie Lincoln, in the voices of Tommy Lee Jones playing Senator Thaddeus Stevens and Daniel Day-Lewis playing Lincoln.
Land appropriations, revolutionary tribunals.
When the war ends, I intend to push for full equality, the Negro vote, and much more. Congress shall mandate the seizure of every foot of rebel land and every dollar of their property. We'll use their confiscated wealth to establish hundreds of thousands of free Negro farmers, and at their side, soldiers armed to occupy and transform the heritage of traitors. We'll build up a land down there of free men and free women and free children and freedom. The nation needs to know that we have such plans.
That's the untempered version of Reconstruction. It's not quite exactly what I intend.
Eric Foner. There's Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln. We know he was a politician and an improviser. Play the counterfactual that he lived.
Yeah, first of all, of course, that conversation never took place in actual history. And the Spielberg movie is fiction, which is, you know, how people ought to view it. Historical fiction. It's not real history.
When the legend becomes fact, we say, print the legend.
It distorts many, many aspects. But I don't want to enter the movie. You know, what Lincoln would have done, nobody knows. As I said before, I think he would have worked with Congress in a creative manner, as he did during the Civil War. He was not a radical Republican. That is correct. The radicals didn't control Congress. It was the moderates who controlled Congress. But even the moderates wanted, by 1866, equal rights for blacks, equal civil rights. They were opposed to Johnson's policies, and by 1867 they came to support black suffrage. And I think Lincoln, as a moderate Republican, would probably have moved in the same direction that the vast majority of moderates in Congress did. White Southern intransigence, white Southern unwillingness to accept the results of the war and the reality of the end of slavery pushed these people in a more radical direction. And I think it would have had the same effect on Lincoln.
Let me put it to Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of 19th century American history at Boston College. To Make Men Free is her latest book on the tensions at the heart of the Republican Party from the beginning. She writes on Salon about politics today in a historically informed voice, if that's the way to put it, and we'll get to today. But, Heather, could it have ended differently?
Well, it's important to remember that Reconstruction is not simply about reconstructing the South and reconstructing the lives of African Americans, but also reconstructing an American government and reconstructing the entire nation. So really what Lincoln, I think, is up to and what the Republicans are up to is trying to rebuild a country based on a government that affords equality of opportunity to every man at this point. But women are also agitating for a role in American society. If you put those factors back in, the tensions seem to me to be greater in a way, but offer more room for possibility. If you look at, for example, at the Civil Rights Act that Eric talked about of 66 and then what gets put into the 14th Amendment, very deliberately Congress says this is about birthright citizenship for everybody, not just for African Americans, but for Chinese and Fiji Islanders and Indians. We want a world where every man in those days, but of course women are agitating for the vote as well, has a right to a say in his government. And that's a complete reworking of the country from what it was before the war when slave owners ran everything.
And it is, we remind ourselves, nation-building time, sort of coast to coast. Fit these issues, these stories, including the industrial issues, but the conscription issues, the central government issues, into the whole map. What's being settled here? What's being tested?
Well, one of the things that Eric started with and that is so central to Reconstruction is that during the Civil War, the Republicans dramatically expand the size of the federal government. And one of the things they do is they invent our first national taxes. So the idea that, in fact, the government should be used to promote equality of opportunity for every man infuriates people who insist that their tax dollars are being used for lazy people who are unwilling to work. And during Reconstruction, one of the key pieces of the way it falls apart is that the language of white Democrats, Democratic men, who say that tax dollars are being used, white tax dollars are being used to support black people in the South, begins to get traction in the North, especially when the labor movement rises in northern cities and then when there's a terrible depression in 1873. The idea that you cannot have an activist government that promotes equality of opportunity across the South for African Americans or protects Chinese in California or even helps women out in Wyoming, because what that will mean is that the government is going to have to take white tax dollars to put in soldiers, to put in bureaucrats, to put in people who will use government money to help populations that are not contributing to a tax base. And that's language that we still live with today.
I was going to say, another link to this moment. Could I just broaden the frame for just a moment? Emancipation time happened in Russia, in the British colonies around the same time. Nowhere else did it lead to a civil war like ours. Civil wars happen all over the place, including China and Rwanda and, you know, Iraq today. Why was ours so difficult and so it seems unhealable at the time? Eric?
Well, you know, I don't know that our civil war was that much more devastating than civil wars that have occurred in many other countries. You know, so one of the things that is a problem for the study of American history is this, the sense, I'm not saying this is what you said, but, you know, of American exceptionalism. Everything that happens here is different from what happened everywhere else. Even the American Civil War was not the most violent war of that era. The War of the Triple Alliance in South America, where three countries ganged up on Paraguay and massacred most of the citizens there, was more bloody than the American Civil War. This is not to say that our war wasn't a devastating conflict, but we should not think that we're the only ones who went through this kind of thing. Civil wars, by definition, are fought in order to reunite the country. Now, if the secessionist group is successful and they win, as sometimes happens, let's say Eritrea winning its war for independence against Ethiopia, then you don't have to worry about that. But if the central government wins, then you always face this problem of how to reunite a country after a very bloody civil war. Let's say Spain had to do that, or Nigeria after the Biafran effort at secession. So in other words, Heather, of course, is right when she said before that we have to look at the whole nation, not just the South, the West, the North, the reconstructions going on there, but also looking more broadly at what has happened, what happened in terms of nation building and conflicts over local autonomy and secession, and that in other countries might help us, you know, think in more creative ways about our own experience as well. But the one thing we have to get away from is the idea that of American exceptionalism, that, you know, we are sort of exempt from the patterns of history that affect everybody else. Because, as you said, the end of slavery happened in many, many places in the 19th century. Serfdom's abolished around the same time in Russia. Slavery had been abolished in the British Empire 30 years earlier. It's abolished a little bit later in Cuba, in Brazil. Every country that had slavery had to go through a process of how to deal with the transition from slavery to freedom. In no place was it easy. Now, it is true in the U.S., I think there was a much greater effort to create for a while this notion of equality, which Heather just mentioned, not only for blacks, but as a general principle for the whole society, which did make this a very remarkable experiment in democracy.
I love to be reminded that we're not unique, but we are exemplary, if only because we declare ourselves exemplary.
Well, that's where we are exceptional. We are exceptional in our insistence that we are exceptional. Most other countries are perfectly happy to think that they may be similar to other places, but we don't seem to like that idea.
I want to put it to Heather. What should country X out there reasonably learn from our Civil War experience?
Well,
what's the moral?
Let me throw this one back to Eric. The country that he didn't mention in terms of civil wars that were devastating is, of course, China, which has the Taiping Rebellion at the exact same time we have the American Civil War. And the way they cleaned up their reconstruction was simply to wipe out the rebels entirely. So there is no memory of them, and they had no say in the reforming of that society, which led to much later problems, of course. But one of the things that so shapes our reconstruction and our reconstruction troubles and why they still echo in the present is because there were no mass executions. There was no attempt to try and wipe out the whole idea of secession, because there was the idea that the Northern experience, the Northern system of free labor, was so extraordinarily successful that anybody in their right minds would want to jump on board with this. What the Northerners could not manage to foresee and to understand the extraordinary depth of was the racism, and how that would be able to be put into our political conversation, so that when we defined who was in a new country versus who was out of a new country, we defined it in a very different way than, say, China did.
Eric Foner?
Yeah, I agree. And of course, to just develop that point for a second that Heather was just making, one of the mythologies of Reconstruction, and this is a period which is overlain with various mythologies in historical writing and popular understanding, and you actually picked that up in the You Are There episode, is that, you know, that the North treated the South really harshly. The South was punished after Reconstruction. Thaddeus Stevens was vindictive toward the South or the radicals. If you look at other countries that had civil wars, it's astonishing how leniently the rebels were treated once the war was over. No, as Heather said, nobody was executed except Wirtz, the commander of commandant of Andersonville Prison, and that was basically for what you call war crimes. I mean, the death of thousands of prisoners of war in his camp. Jefferson Davis died in his bed. So did Alexander Stevens. Nobody bothered them. You know, and Southerners, with a few exceptions, were not deprived of their basic rights, white Southerners. What the opponents of Reconstruction called harshness and punishment was giving rights to black people. That was considered a punishment to whites. And you see echoes of that even today, the idea that rights are a kind of zero-sum game. If some group gets more rights, it must be taken away from someone else.
My next question, you know, it comes out of that, Eric Foner, is sort of how did the defeated South build its story into the bedrock of sort of national mythology and the political system through the liberal Franklin Roosevelt, through the liberal John F. Kennedy through into the 1960s.
It lasted a long time. Well, they say, you know,
the solid South, you can't talk about civil rights, this kind of thing.
Right. The North won the war and the South won the historical battle over the war. And I think the reason is, and Heather mentioned this briefly, I think, a little while ago, is that by the ending point, by the time Reconstruction is waning and then in the generation after that, up to the, let's say, 1900, racism became even more embedded in the country than it had been before. By 1900, you know, the notion of the white man's burden, the notion of social Darwinism also helps to reinforce this. Racism was a point of unity between the white North and the white South, and part of that was a vision of the Civil War, forgetting about the issue of slavery. Of course, David Blight, I think he was on your show a while ago.
Last week.
Wrote about this, you know, forgetting about slavery as the fundamental problem in the war, but and the abolition of slavery as a basic consequence, and you know, a sort of united, a reconciliationist view of the war, where it was really brother against brother, you know, northern white, southern white, but that left the blacks out altogether. They weren't the brothers of these southern slave owners.
But can I add to that, though, and that is to say that it's not just racism. It's that unique Reconstruction link between the idea that African Americans and other minority groups, but especially African Americans, are somehow advocating a redistribution of wealth. That if they get a say at all in American society, what they will do is they'll vote for legislators who will do stupid things like waste money building roads and hospitals and schools and taking care of people who get injured at work. And if you do that, that's going to be white tax dollars being used for a minority population or a population that has been defined as being lazy. And that's some form of socialism that's going to destroy America. And that word socialism comes into the American lexicon in 1871 as a negative thing. And that link between African Americans and the destruction of America at its very core is laid down in the early years of Reconstruction, and we've lived with it ever since.
Isn't it fascinating that we're building up or seeing in the 1860s the sort of fundamental structure of right and left impulses in this country, maybe in all human communities, between matters of control, hierarchy, inclusion, taxation, care for the poor, care for the sick, this kind of thing. It's all one spectrum then and now almost.
Well, now, see, I'd like to hear what Eric has to say about that, because that's one place I do think America is exceptional, in that we get our first national taxation and we get African-American voting within a very few years of each other. And that is, I think, a unique thing to America, and why we get this weird idea that any kind of activist government is somehow redistributing wealth to minorities.
Well, your turn, Eric Foner.
I don't disagree with what Heather said at all, but I do think we have to, you know, we should remember that these issues were highly contested even among whites. I mean, as you well know, the Gilded Age, you said Reconstruction and the Gilded Age are two different ways of talking about fundamentally the same time period. And in the Gilded Age, there was bitter labor conflict in the North and in the South, but in the, you know, among white workers and the, you know, the Knights of Labor, there were bitter, violent labor strikes. The Great Railroad Strike of 1877, for example, the Haymarket, issues in the 1880s. In other words, there were a lot of white people who it's not just a race issue, but there were also a lot of white people who thought that government should be doing much more than it had been, and were calling for things like the 8-hour day, for regulation of labor conditions and things like that. So these issues are always contested. They were then, and they are now, and they're not purely contested along racial lines.
I was just going to say, are you discounting the crucial significance of race in the whole story?
I'm not discounting it at all, but the issues that Heather was mentioning about the role of government and the uplifting of the poor is not a racial question. There are more white poor in this country than black poor, and there always have been.
Well, no, but certainly in the 1870s, when you get the rise of the labor movement and the fears of Chicago burning in 1871, when it comes down in October, the idea that there are poor workers run amok trying to take over the government and get the government to do things for them using white tax dollars or wealthy tax dollars, redistributing wealth downward as opposed to the upward direction it was actually going. It's not solely based on race, but certainly fears of a lower class taking over the government are heightened by the fact that African Americans are voting for the first time.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you read, James S. Pike in his famous diatribe against Reconstruction.
71 in the Times and
prostrate,
73, yeah.
Prostrate state of, you know, South Carolina. Pike says, you know, here's there's all this corruption, et cetera, and it's the he compares the what he calls the, you know, the rule of barbarism, that is blacks in South Carolina, with the immigrant rule in New York City.
Absolutely.
Tammany Hall, you know, the Democratic political machine using the votes of immigrants. Again, as Heather said, it's poor people who are trying to use the government to assist themselves. But, you know, I don't believe that there is a inborn American sentiment that is permanent along these lines. I mean, after all, a generation or so later, you get the progressive era where there's widespread support for very activist government in all sorts of ways. The New Deal showed the same thing, the Great Society. You know, these things do rise. Now, today, of course, we have the opposite being very dominant, it seems, you know, hostility to government and hostility to taxation and hostility to any kind of assistance to those who are less well off.
The tensions are incredibly familiar, even if the names on the teams have switched. Absolutely. Yesterday's Republicans, today's Democrats, and vice versa. I'm still having a hard time getting my head around even seeing the Gilded Age and Reconstruction in the same frame, but we'll come back to it. When we come back, the resonance of Reconstruction in the souls of black folk in W.E. Boyce's Du Bois's title. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Our guest, Eric Foner, speaks of the 14 years of Reconstruction at the end of the Civil War as a noble but failed attempt at interracial democracy. Failed but never forgotten. A splendid failure, as W.E.B. Du Bois said. Listen to this utopian radio drama from 1948 in a series called Destination Freedom. The time is roughly a decade after emancipation, and a newly elected black state senator from Mississippi is regaling white farmers and freed blacks with their rising success building a new South on a repurposed plantation.
All right, gentlemen, I'll say a word. A word I would have said to the men in white robes who came looking for me today. Something Lincoln said.
Now, Charles, don't keep quoting Mr. Lincoln.
Maze of Fred, I'll come to the same end as Lincoln if I keep using the same words. I'll say this. We're starting out on a good year, friends, all of us. On the same side. On the ground that was once a plantation. Planning how to make it so there'll be more freedom. Sure freedom for everyone this year. And we'll do it. There's a civil rights bill to be passed in Washington that'll wipe out every trace of the old system, gentlemen. The last 10 years have been good. This'll be better. We, the poor whites and the Negro freedmen, we are the majority, not the old slaveholders. We know they organize bands against us and wait on their plantations like wounded lions, ready to split us apart when we quarrel. But for 8 years, we've been together. You've even elected me a senator. They voted against us. We were stronger.
I don't know now, bro.
And we'll get on with reconstructing the state for the benefit of all the people in it, not for a few who still hold the land.
Yeah, but when the troops are withdrawn, Senator...
The governor has promised that the troops will stay until the changes are made.
But the planters, they're still waiting for a chance to...
Let them wait. They're Bourbons now, like the old Bourbons in France, clinging to an old, decayed way of living. They'll defy the new Civil Rights Amendment. They'll poison us in their papers. They'll play one of us against the other. But if we keep white and Negro together here in the South for 5 more years, we'll win out. We'll have a democracy.
That was black radio drama in Chicago, 1948, the sort of thing for which Reconstruction seemed to have been made. Heather, just touch on the point that this was, for writers like W.E.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass also, this was a golden time.
Well, and it goes back to something Eric said before about how out of this we get things like the progressive era and some of our great progress in American society. Because while we tend to remember Reconstruction as a negative time, A time when, in fact, everybody was going to have a say in their government, not just African Americans, but also women who begin voting in 1872 in a vote-in. That's when Susan B. Anthony goes to jail for the crime of voting. The idea that regular people would have control of their government and manage to create a government that would enable everybody to rise or to be able to rise and to protect what they made with their own hands is an incredibly exciting time. It's a time of great possibility. And in the, from 1875 to about 1889, it looks like it might work. Not always, and there's cracks in it, but it is a time when it looks like regular people are going to be able to have control over their government. And they take to the streets to fight for it in the Great Railroad Strike, for example, of 77. The idea that they could do it is a very exciting time.
Eric Foner, come back to the links such as they were between the oligarchs, the formation of the Great Railroad, Rockefeller, Vanderbilt fortunes, and the naked oligarchy of the South.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. And, you know, it's, as I said before, there are two ways of describing this period, Reconstruction, Gilded Age, and there are historians, Heather has done this better than most people, but historians have not fully put those two together. There's a whole literature on the Gilded Age. There's a whole literature on Reconstruction. They often don't quite speak to each other. I think the point is that, yeah, look, as Charles Beard and Mary Beard said a long time ago, among other things, the Civil War displaced the old planter elite from political control in Washington, and the Republican Party increasingly becomes in the North the party of the, you know, the very powerful industrialists and, you know, the economic powers that be. It's a very odd coalition because in the South it's based on these very poor emancipated slaves, and in the North it's more and more in the interests of, you know, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and people like that. So, but those people's natural allies in the South are not African Americans, but the old planters, the people like themselves. So there's an inherent tension in this, which eventually may, you know, contributes to the ending of Reconstruction, that the willingness in the North among Republicans to keep intervening in the South to protect the rights of former slaves begins to wane for many reasons. Some of them Heather explained in terms of fear of ordinary people using the government and tax money for these purposes, but also a kind of, you know, a kind of a sentiment develops that Reconstruction was a mistake, that, you know, that to try to uplift the lower orders of society is a mistake. And really the natural rulers of society ought to be back in power in the South. And that view begins to get more and more, you know, more and more attractive to many in the North, even those who supported Reconstruction at the beginning.
But Heather, to pick up on that, going back to what you were talking about, Chris, about the reflection of the Southern oligarchy in the North, it's really interesting that in 1858, a major Southern planter, James Henry Hammond, gives a speech in Congress in which he says, you know, just what Eric said, basically the rich should rule. Now, when Carnegie does his Gospel of Wealth that everybody's heard about in 1889, he says pretty much the same thing. And you see the same language again in the 1920s, and you see it again in the last 30 years. It's a really interesting echo of the Reconstruction years that, in fact, you should have the very wealthy at the top of society versus the idea that everybody should have a say in their government.
I wonder, Heather, how you make a connection between money power then and money power today, and the, you know, the opposite issues of fairness, inclusion, fraternity, whatever we want to call it.
Well, on the very broadest scale, I think the question of for whom should the American government work is the fundamental question that we have grappled with since the very first day of Reconstruction. Who is really the government supposed to be working for? And that question, whether it's for everybody so that everybody has equality of opportunity and can rise, or is it the very wealthy so that they can amass a fortune and move society forward by directing it? That is a central question of American society, and it takes on many different forms, and it morphs for sure, and different parties have espoused it at different times. But that fundamental question is one we still grapple with every day.
Explain how we grapple with it today. I mean, how we're going to grapple with it in 2016. It sounds to me like a lot of these old buzzwords are current. Maybe always have been, but in a special way again today.
Well, if you can step back and look at how we view the federal government, what should it do? For whom should it work? Should it be helping the makers, if you will, by creating extraordinarily low taxes, by making sure that wealth amasses at the top of society so you create a small group who can move things in a direction that they think is right because they're smart and they're educated and they know how to use their money? Or should the federal government be helping as many people as possible to be able to rise into middle class, into a competency, into a place where they can feed their kids and move their own way up through society? That's a central tension, and it's a tension that speaks directly to what Lincoln was up to during when he helped to form the Republican Party, and what the early Republicans were at work at in Reconstruction, and how during Reconstruction the weight shifts from a government that should work for everybody, giving everybody a say, African Americans, women, immigrants, to a government that only really reflects the needs and the wants of a very few wealthy people.
Eric Foner, how do you apply it to the inequality issues?
Heather certainly identified a key issue there. I mean, another one that is very resonant from Reconstruction to the present, which is, you know, it's fundamentally the same issue, but it's the right to vote. Who should actually have the right to vote?
Yep.
I mean, we are, you know, people kind of take for granted that the right to vote is essential to democracy, but they don't necessarily realize that it's always contested as to who ought to be exercising that. And we have seen in many states in the last 3 or 4 years, you know, efforts to restrict the right to vote or limit the right to vote or limit access to the right to vote for poorer people of all races, really. And that speaks back to the issue that Heather was talking about who the government should really be working for. And, of course, as happened in the retreat from Reconstruction, the Supreme Court in our own time has played a role in this retreat. I mean, you know, just a couple of years ago, they invalidated the Voting Rights Act of 1865, one of the key achievements of the civil rights movement, which was passed under the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. I mean, it was authorized by the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which was enacted during Reconstruction. So you see Reconstruction kind of reverberating 100 years later in the Voting Rights Act, and then 50 years after that, or almost, the Supreme Court says, no, we don't really have to tell states that they can't start, restricting the right to vote. So you see these patterns occurring at a number, at different times in American history.
And how about immigration and this incredibly important matter of birthright citizenship? If you're born here, you're an American.
Well, that's a Reconstruction principle. It was put into the law in the Civil Rights Act of 1866. It was put into the Constitution in the 14th Amendment. Any person born in the United States, with the exception of Native Americans who at that time were living on reservations, who at that time were considered, members of their own tribal sovereignties. But anybody born in the United States is a citizen, and that's true today. Now, there are many people who don't like that idea. There have been many states who have tried to figure out ways of getting around it. They don't like the idea that the children of illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants are born here or are citizens, regardless of what the status of their parents is. But that is a basic statement of a view that American citizenship should be open to all and that all citizens should be treated equally. That's a Reconstruction principle. It's not just a racial principle, as Heather said. But today it's highly contested, and there are many, many people who would like to get rid of the 14th Amendment altogether.
Well, what's interesting about that is that, in fact, in the Civil Rights Act of 66, as Eric says, the Congress puts in the language that being born here meant that you were a citizen. And when Johnson vetoes that in his veto message, he literally says, surely you don't mean to include Chinese people and islanders and, he doesn't call them biracial people, but, surely you don't mean this. And Congress turns around and puts the exact same language into the 14th Amendment, which to me is a huge, oh, yes, we do mean this. So every time people argue about that, I always want to say, go back and look at the veto message because Congress was very clear about that. I wanted to make a point, though, about voting and voting restrictions. One of the interesting things about Reconstruction that we tend to forget to fold in is that women work very, very hard hard to get voting rights during Reconstruction. And in fact, it's an attempt to keep women from voting that opens the door to restricting black voting. And that's a Supreme Court case of 1875 called Minor v. Happersett, in which the court has to decide whether or not women are citizens. And they go on for a very long, boring time about how women are, in fact, citizens. Mm. And in the zinger at the very end, they say, but being a citizen does not necessarily give you the right to vote. And all of a sudden, right there, you can get people out of voting by grandfather clauses and poll taxes and literacy clauses, which again has been proposed as to again, as Eric says, that whole tangle of Reconstruction of who gets to have a say feeds off each other. Who is a good citizen and who is not? And how do we define that? And we're still playing the same game.
Speaking of games, is it not fascinating the silence on the T word, terrorism? We see it. We see terrorism at the drop of a hat today. It seems to nobody seems to have called the bluff on the Klan and the power of sheer terrorism through Reconstruction.
They did actually speak. People spoke about a reign of terror in parts of the South, in letters, in petitions to the federal government to send troops and others to crush the Klan. The word terrorism is probably a neologism. It wasn't around back then, but they certainly talked about a reign of terror.
That sounds like France in 1789 or something.
Yeah, in parts of the South. And, this is homegrown terrorism. This is not imported from abroad. It's not Muslim or Islamic terrorism like people talk about today. These are good Christian people who are putting on disguises and running around murdering their neighbors at night. And, it was very hard to deal with. The government, the southern governments seemed to be too weak to deal with it. The federal government intervened at first under President Grant. He did crush the Klan, really, in 1871-72, but then violence rears its head again a couple of years later, and by that time the will to intervene to fight them has considerably diminished. So, we had a very our confrontation with homegrown terrorism came in Reconstruction, and it was not successfully dealt with.
I wonder at this point in the hour, what we learned from Reconstruction. I love Frederick Douglass's line as to what it taught us. He said that no republic is safe that tolerates a privileged class or denies to any of its citizens equal rights and equal means to maintain them. What should we learn, Eric Foner?
There's a lot of lessons of Reconstruction. It's not you can't take it one-to-one to the present. We're 150 years later. We're in a different society. 40 eggs and a mule is not going to do you that much good today. But, we learn, I think, first of all, that I think we can be inspired by the effort of ordinary people, ordinary black and white people, former slaves, former poor whites and others, to actually change society, to actually make this a better country, to try to implement genuine democracy in the South. I think that can be an inspiration to us. But also, I think the lesson of Reconstruction is that rights are never secure. You cannot take them for granted. Things were put into the laws, things were put into the Constitution, but they did not stick. They were violated.
They were not enforced.
They were completely abrogated in the generation later on, even though those things were still in the Constitution. So, rights on paper are not sufficient. They have to be reinvigorated by every generation.
Heather Cox Richardson, what should we have learned?
Well, I think I'm going to echo Frederick Douglass here and say that's exactly, to build on what Eric said, that's exactly right, that people need to be protective of their rights and to recognize that they must be fought for, and that if we don't manage to keep the government working for everybody, we end up in a terrible mess, but that the real lesson of Reconstruction is that we have possibilities, but it's so easy to let the language of exclusion versus inclusion end up tearing our possibilities apart. And that's the lesson we need to learn.
I like W.E.B. Du Bois's line in a book on black Reconstruction in the 1930s. He said, the unending tragedy of Reconstruction is the utter inability of the American mind to grasp its real significance, its national and worldwide implications. We're still too blind and infatuated, he writes, to conceive of the emancipation of the laboring class in half the nation as a revolution comparable to the upheavals in France, Russia, Spain, China, the rest. Thank you, Heather Cox Richardson and Eric Foner in New York. We're going out on the spiritual Wade in the Water, performed by the Blind Boys of Alabama. Check out our website, radioopensource.org. You can find a guided tour to Civil War sites around Boston, of all places, a reminder that our town took a, yes, exceptional part in America's Second Revolution. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Tomeno. George Hicks is our engineer, with help from Kunal Jasti in New York. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. In the water.